plan it. We're in the middle of planning. Check with Stephanie. And they want to be sure the books get here. In other words, to have a book launch without books does not make sense. Mark, where is your better half? This is, your daughter is? I hope for good reasons. When a woman's unwell, it can be unwell, or it can be unwell for good reasons. I understand, I hear. So I'm just saying, I hope for good reasons. Alright, I can begin. Today is Monday morning, March 24th, 2014. As I said a minute ago, next week are the last classes before Pesach. I want to say hello to all my wonderful students in front of me. I have to shift gears because yesterday I gave a major shiur on the heart of Pesach and how Pesach works, and on Reb Menashe HaKatan arguing with the Lakewood crowd. It was I got to shift gears into a different world now. Okay. Now, a number of announcements. Number one, Naftali Lavender tells me that the students who want to access the talk I gave on the Chag HaSmicha, it's Rabbi Heschel Schechter, yours truly, and Rabbi Penner, can sign up for www.rabbanan.org, a password-protected website with resources for rabbis. They should write when they register for the site in the section that says others. Gris Kolel, Rabbi Rakefet Shear. Okay? This is all, I'm just reading it. It doesn't make sense to me, and I didn't say Sisrei Torah that you should need a password. It's called www.rabbanan.org. Okay? Now, I also want to mention a Talmud in the Kolel, who studied with me last year. His name is Nathaniel Fishman. His father is professor of Yiddish at JTS. Very interesting. American born, and his grandfather also was a Yiddishist. And his father evidently published, I don't know whether it's a book or articles, on when the Rav originally spoke in Yiddish, the drashot are in Yiddish, not in Hebrew, not in English, but in the Rav's original language. And in his volume, here is the talk I referred to, the talk the Rav gave at the Chinuch Atzmai in 1956. And you have him praising Rav Aaron Cutler. It's very, very moving for me because it's word by word in the original language. Now, a number of corrections, and I'm overjoyed to make corrections. Some people ask me, well, it's so minor what you're correcting. It's not minor. A correction has to be made. A person has to try to be in scholarship as accurate as he can. And when you go out of the field of where you did your doctorate, you're always going to make little mistakes because it's material you pick up, you haven't researched. But with Rav Aaron Cutler and the famous story how Rav Dov Schwartzman became his son-in-law, I juxtapositioned it to Rav Aaron's trip to Israel when I was in Lakewood. It happened before. When I was in Lakewood already in the early 50s, Rav Dov was already his son-in-law. So that story happened. I thank Andrew Rosenberg, who I received such a beautiful email. I learned in Lakewood Yeshiva and I listened to your Shayurim religiously. And he goes on, and he makes the correction, and Andrew, as I wrote to you, you're absolutely right, I stand corrected. It happened earlier than it. Again, if someone will do a critical biography of Rav Aaron, you can go into details, probably work out when he first visited Israel after World War II, to see his wife, to see her mother and father, plain and simple. Chaim Schnitzer, I believe, of Montreal, corrects me, and I mentioned I knew that Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky never wound up in Shanghai. But I made a mistake. He didn't go to Kobe. He came to America in 37. And that can explain why Rav Yaakov was much more at home in the United States.
Canada?
He came to America, to Seattle. And from Seattle, he was rubbing Seattle, And from there he went to Toronto. And I'm just thinking aloud. You see, here it's very sad that Reb Nosson Kamenetsky got so bitterly attacked, and he stopped writing, from what I understand. He was going to put out other volumes on his father. But I'm just thinking aloud that I know the shul, I know Seattle, and I know Toronto. So I have a feeling that he came to Seattle and he became a Rav, but it was an Americanized, real Orthodox shul. The greatness of Toronto was saying Noch geret Yiddishat Mgas. They spoke Yiddish on the street. That was the greatness of Toronto. So evidently he went to Toronto. There were Landschaftmann there. He felt at home, and he remained in Toronto until he was called to New York to take over Torah Vadas. Of course, what's interesting about Toronto, and it would be interesting to see if someone does a biography of you have already in Rabbi Yaakov from Art Scroll, but he in Toronto was the Rav or gave a shir in the Mizrahi, had a very firm connection to the Mizrahi movement. Then when he came to New York and Torah Vadas, it shifted sideways. Now, one of the I don't know if at YU, but there was a whole plan to establish a yeshiva in New England, and the Rav would be the Rosh Yeshiva, and Rav Yaakov would be the Mashkiach. It was a whole plan. There were a lot of big Rabbanim in New England, but it never got off the floor. You see, New York was New York. When all is said and done, the pull of New York, someone said to me, again, I don't want to praise my classmates, but we were a very, very bright group. We were a very bright group. And someone 2 years older than me, very successful in life, said to me, Aaron, just think, the Rav had a face, guys, like you and your classmates. He had to be prepared. You were a challenge for him. And I always thought, what made my era so unique? And I come to a very simple conclusion. I've said this publicly. The Rav was at his intellectual height. There's no two ways about it. And the students, you had a conglomeration of American kids who were determined to make up for everything Hitler destroyed. And you had survivors who somehow had survived and were determined to go further. And they had that ability to conquer the world. We were quite a group. See, and that you could only have in New York. New York was a lodestar. There was a kid who came to YU in my time, Gorlin. This kid came. He was, what was he, in Arizona? You got to check out the story. And his parents were worried that they were survivors. And the parents were worried, you know, we survived Hitler, what's going to be with our son, what kind of Yiddishkeit can we give him? And they sent the kid to yeshiva with $20 in his pocket. And, right, this is about 1950-51, and YU took the kid in. And of course, if you go to Seattle, he's one of the most famous Jewish citizens in Seattle. He built a senior citizens village that is considered the top one in the entire United States. And it's glatt kosher. I mean, it has Jews, it has goyim, but the village, you can eat in any kitchen there. Now, very interestingly, apropos of what I said in class, and there was a side issue we got involved with, how important Rabbi Aaron Cutler was, that even with the holding pen, I write about it in the Suvi era, whenever they made an innovation, they had to have Rabbi Aaron's approval. Without Reb Aaron, it couldn't get off the floor. So Chaim Schnitzer sent me part of a doctorate done at the Concordia University, Montreal, Quebec, Canada, April 2011. Stephen Lapidus, Orthodoxy in Translation, the Vod HaYir of Montreal in the 20th Century. And here in this doctorate, you see, when Montreal got involved with the holding pen, they brought Reb Aaron Cutler to Montreal as well. Again, they couldn't get off the floor without Reb Aaron. And it just certifies what I said in class and my own feelings that Rabbarin, and I, again, I'm in my Sunday class as well with Reb Menashe Klein and Reb Moshe Feinstein, there is no question, with all due respects to criticism I got from Reb Moshe, someone in Reb Moshe's family, that my, again, he uses the words, my great uncle was the Gadol Hadar, Reb Moshe Feinstein, and I said to say he didn't need Rabbarin. It's not so. Rabbarin was such a personality that the Rav himself, when the Rav had a Paskin Shaila of taking the Jews out of Cuba on Yom Kippur, he calls Rabbarin Kaim. I mean, it shows you who Rabbarin was. I'm not overstating the case, I'm not understating the case. Now, I want to try to finish up Rabbarin today, finish up Lakewood. We have very big, important material coming, but I want to do justice to Rabbarin. And we saw last week about Hapsalar after World War II, Rabbi Baruch Nathan. Again, it's an interesting volume and all that went on, and Rabbarin, again, his personality and how people were attracted to him. And then we saw the memoir of a Kletzka who didn't wind up in Shanghai, who didn't wind up in Kobe, but wound up in Siberia. And here too you see how what it means to make a decision, how sad it is, how earth-shaking it can be. You talk about the people in Vilna and how the communists are asking them, do you want to become citizens? Don't you want to become citizens? And how logically would you think? You would say you don't want to, you do want to be a citizen. You're afraid. Communism, you people here have no concept of what communism was. I have a better concept than anyone in this room, including Yosef Mordechai. You grew up in the Ukraine when the statues were falling. Yitzchak has a bit of a concept. But I used to say, when I came back from communist Russia and I could talk to a few people who were within, I used to say, boy, the communists are smarter than we are. We believe in a God who you can't touch. And boy, in Russia, on every street corner, you could touch God. Statues of Stalin and Marx and Engels, Getchkins, all over the place. You went into the Beryuska, that you could buy any little monument, any little statue, any little coin, I still have in my house Lenin. I show it to people, they think it's here. I had a beard, a little beard, they think it's a Rav, they think it's a Gadol Yisrael. I tell them, this is Lenin. So, you have no idea, and yet the people who chose communist citizenship, a few months later, Hitler comes in, breaks every deal, kills them like flies, and the people who went to Siberia lived. And you know, that's life. I can only tell you, I look back 45 years ago, and I look at my friends, and I see those who came in Aliyah. You look 45 years later, the children, the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren, you made a little decision, but wow, what the implications are. 45, I don't want to talk about my family, I'll only say one line. The values my grandchildren have, and the values the grandchildren of the people living in Lawrence and in some other well-to-do communities, compare their values. There's nothing, there's no comparison. On a scale of 1 to 10, you're comparing 1 to 10, and I need not tell you where the 10 is. Now, what's so beautiful about this memoir, and I apologize, I cried so much last week, I can't help myself, what can I tell you? I cry, it's the soul crying, a Jewish soul, what we've lived here, the enmity, the hatred, the mudslinging. I couldn't believe some of the things that happened, but it really happened. I mean, I couldn't believe what I'm seeing in Modia, what I'm seeing in Yafet Ne'eman. What I'm seeing in, I can't even keep track of all the, what I'm seeing in Shas, the words, the leaders, the language, Rav Kohn, Rav, let me not use the term Rav, and his own grandchildren, where he puts regard, Amalek, wow. What we've lived through. And here you see a person arrives in America, no relatives, who knows how many of his family survived the Holocaust, comes with his young wife, she gives birth a few weeks later, and take a look at Mr. Bunim, for a total stranger, makes a Brit, makes a meal, look at the person in the bakery who didn't want to take any money from him, but he's buying cakes. He doesn't have enough money to make. He had no idea what Mr. Bunim would do, and he's buying cakes, and he doesn't want to take any money from him. And you're from Kletsk, I'm from Kletsk, and this is Migid. You can understand why the Rebbeinu Shel Olam wears in his tefillin, Mikamcha Yisrael Goyachad Baretz. That's all. I don't want to comment further. And I'm proud. We did what we could. I've given many drashot on it. I've based upon my Rebbe's words of Al Chet Shechatan Al Fanech in World War II that we didn't do enough. And Baruch Hashem, when it came to Russian Jewry, we did. We answered the call. Now, and I also mentioned last week, and it's a very important topic, and I can't tell you who is right. You can debate it, and then when Mashiach comes, maybe then we'll find out who is right. But how Rav Aaron Cutler did not participate in the 1943 march on Washington, D.C. See, Rav Aaron held Shtaplanut, the old system. You have to deal with the government, Malchut Shel Chesed, and the Mishaberach for the government, and not to show the government up. And for the Rav, that was a turning point in his life, that he recognized what a terrible mistake I made by being an Agudist. And from that point on, he identifies with the Mizrahi. And that's a very interesting question. It comes up time and again. How do we react? How do we deal? What do we do? It's fascinating. Reb Lezer Silva have material there, the Madison Square Garden. Demonstrate, not to demonstrate, boycott Hitler, don't boycott Hitler. Fascinating question. But you see, Rav Aaron did not attend, and that is of interest. That even as late as 43, with all this activity for the Bar Hatzalah, but he chose not to challenge Roosevelt in public. Now, there's one other part to Rav Aaron's life, and I want to show you a source that you will find unbelievably fascinating. With all we've said about Rav Aaron, imagine had he chosen to go to Palestine instead of the United States. It's food for thought. What would have become in America? What would have been in Palestine? But this question of where do we go? Do we remain where we feel we can do, where we can accomplish, where we're needed, or do we go to Eretz Yisrael? This question haunts us until today. It's a question, for the sake of argument, in my time, it was well known that if you asked the Rav or you asked the Lubavitcher Rebbe, should you go in Aliyah, the answer you got was absolutely no. I can give you names of rabbis who asked the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and the answer he got was absolutely no. The Rav was not a Rebbe. In other words, a Rebbe, by definition, if you're a Rebbe, you have to be able to tell a chassid yes or no, you have to be able to slap his face, or you have to be able to encourage him. He expects an answer. The Rav, by definition, we're going to see that in the tshuva. I'm going to show you something fascinating, a sideshow in a few minutes. The Rav, by definition, was not going to tell you yes or no. But I can tell you, if I had gone to Rebbe, and this is based upon conversations I had with Rebbe during the years in the 60s, if I would have gone to Rebbe, I would have said, Rebbe, should I go in Aliyah? What was he? Is that Meshuggah? Is that Azei Matzliach, though? You're so successful. The Kinder, you know, he once gave me a compliment that he heard. I can have young kids all excited about a Tosfot. You understand? So if you're Matzliach in learning, you know the language, you know the mentality, why do you want to go in Aliyah? Now this question, it haunts us until today. It haunts us right here in Grus Kollel. There's a sign up downstairs that the czar of the Center for the Jewish Future, founder, a czar, I don't know of a better word to use, a man who has done so much, Rabbi Kenny Brander is coming. People are signing up to be interviewed by him. What are they signing up for? They want positions. The next year they have to go into the rabbinate, have to go into chinuch, have to finish up smicha. No, Why, where are you going? You're going back to America? How are you going back to America? It's yeah. Israel, a mitzvah, there's a kibbutz. What do you have to say, Yoni? Yeah.
He has position
available
in Israel also.
Baruch Hashem, Yoni, I'm happy to hear that. But the people I know who signed up are committed to going back to America. I'm not chayshish that Yoni Miller is going to leave Eretz Yisrael. Chas v'chalil. I'm not chayshish that. So, and this is a very valid question. I've lectured on this. I have the Rakefet approach. It's not for now. Rakefet is so smart or so stupid, he thinks he can solve all problems. So I have the Rakefet approach, how to solve the problem of providing leadership for the Gola and living in Israel. But we'll leave that for another time. We'll leave it for next Purim, Be'ezrat Hashem. Okay, Bulineda. Let's come back here. So, this is a valid question. Who received this question? The Sri Deyesh. And here I have to tell you, the Sri Deyesh had a miserable, miserable life. Let's be honest. I feel as if I knew the Sri Deyesh personally, because I knew and know many of his Talmidim, I'll use the word, intimately. So, he had a miserable life. He was learning in Slabatka, he loved Slabatka, but he was broad-minded. The Mashgiach did all kinds of shtick on him, Rav Nosson Tzvi. Because in those years, 120 years ago, if you were broad-minded, you threw Yiddish kind away. That's the way it worked. So he married him off to a Rav. There was a Shtela Tzul Shviki. The Rav had died. The daughter came with the rabbinate. And it was apples and oranges. And it didn't work out. They got divorced. He ran away to Berlin, gets a doctorate, and becomes head of the seminary. Never remarried. And that is said, a person has to marry a person. It's very important to marry, because marriage turns you into a Baal Chesed. If you have any seichel, it teaches you how to compromise. It teaches you how to be a Baal Chesed. Look at the Rambam Hilchat Ishut. I've lectured on it too. Perek Tetvav Halacha Yetet Halacha Chaf. It teaches you that if a happily married man is more concerned with his wife than he is with himself, and vice versa. And when you have that feeling, it's and then you have children. And children, yes, we can have atmos nefesh, and they're a pain in the neck, and they cost a lot of money. But I have to tell you, Baruch Hashem, children are children, and children grow old, and if they had good rebbeim, they learn what parents are worth, okay? So you have to marry, and children, he never remarried. And I can understand that some people are hesitant, they're so used to living alone already. But Baruch Hashem, do what God commanded. Ellie, but then it goes further. He went through hell in World War II. He wound up in Warsaw. He barely survived. Druma had it. He lost his mind. They're talking about Gonadi, who was the biggest thief in the yeshiva world 120 years ago. And then finally, he gets out. He's liberated. Where does he turn? Where does he go? Everyone else sought their relatives. He had no relatives. He had no wife, no children. He had a student, Baruch Hashem. So he winds up in Switzerland. His student was well-to-do. They ran a business. His student didn't take any money, ran a yeshiva, no money for the yeshiva. They had a business. I think it was manufacturing women's clothing, and that supported the family. The student was Weingart. He was married to Butchko, and Rabbi Butchko, whose family ran this business, had established the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva, and he took in his Rebbe, and he had a mother and daughter house relationship with a little apartment on the side. And he said to Rabbi Chiel, this is where you stay, this is where you live. And Rabbi Chiel was starting to resuscitate himself. And within a year, his Talmud is killed by a chashmalit, by a trolley car, we would say in English. Killed, waiting for the trolley car, was thinking. It's a whole story. I can go into more detail, but it would eat up another hour. And never, he remained there with the widow, and he raised his Talmud had a very bright little kid, Avraham Abba, and Rabbi Chiel Yaakov raised Rabbi Avraham Abba on his lap. And then he had all kinds of invitations, with all due respect to Switzerland, Ribbono Shel Olam, what do you amount to there? Who's there? What's there? Jerusalem is on the map already. Imagine had the Rav remained in Boston and never come to New York, we wouldn't talk about him. There was a guy in Griscola, I forgot his name, he spent 22 years in his Monday class, Shayurim on the Rav, without repeating a lecture. 22 years, okay? And that wasn't even going into Top Lumbus, it was just the more general lectures. And had the Rav not come to New York, so Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov had many invitations to come to Israel, to come to Jerusalem, and he couldn't accept. He said, why? He said, where am I going to go? The Hebrew you invited me, if I go there, Hebron will put me in Cherem. Hebron Yeshiva invited me, which is Slabatka, right? If I go there, the Hebrew you will put me in Cherem. At least when I stay in Switzerland, no one is putting me into Cherem. There's no Hebrew you here, and there's no Hebron here. So he had a very sad life. But he was Zeicher, I'll say one thing, that Rav Avraham Abba devotes his life to putting out his Rebbe's writings and makes addendums and Baruch Hashem, what they have done to perpetuate Rav Weinberg's memory is second to none. Now, I'm quoting from the Chidushei Baal Sridei HaEsh Al Hashas Chelik Gimel page Shin Ayin Dalet. And I, in this volume, put out by Rav Avraham Abba Weingurt, who lives on Rehov Chernichovsky and is my good friend, who's married to my student, my very first student in Michalar, Israeli Division postgraduate, Jonah Levy, who knew Shisha Sidrei Mishnah by heart when I taught her. And it was in my class she first heard about the Sridei Eish. And a few years later, she marries the Sridei Eish, top Talmud after World War II. Beginning on page Shin Ayin Dalet, what a fascinating question correspondence. Again, it's someone I knew, taught his family, Rav Yaakov Fink. Anyone here from Haifa? He was Rav in Haifa, I believe already in the 60s into the 70s. He was a gonadir, a tremendous mind, a yeki, or at least educated in Germany by Makar, very broad-minded. In other words, he already combined, he was from Torim Derech Eretz, but real top learning, in addition, a broad point of view. And he finally finds a job in Haifa. He's a Rav, he teaches, and then he is offered a big position in Chutz La'aretz, in Antwerp. Okay, this probably is before, who did they take Rabbi Kreis with, Rabbi Chaim Kreis with, who had been in Chicago. This is probably before, it has to be checked out, but I'm pretty sure I'm right. He went up after World War II, finally finds himself in Haifa, and now he's offered a big position, heavy money, Antwerp then is the Elizabeth Center, but today already the diamond industry is down, it's moved to India, if you know what's happened, it's affected B'nai Brak as well, and Antwerp it's had its problems to say the least, although there is a really strong Haredi community there, which right now, if you know details, is fighting with the government over the Taliban. It's not very different than what's going on here. I believe the Supreme Court of Belgium has to give a decision, and he's invited to the rabbinate. So he doesn't know what to do, and this is the Yetzer Hara. I can tell you it's the Yetzer Hara. I was starving here. This is right after the Yom Kippur War. And a very prominent Jewish leader, you call him whatever you wish, offers me $50,000. This is January 1974 in the lobby of the King's Hotel. Put that into 2014 money. $50,000. It's like offering me $500,000 to come to America and be dean of students at an institution that we can't mention in YU, or Richard Joel will give me a phone call. That's a big Yetzer Hara, you understand? You have no money for food the fourth Shabbos of the week, and here someone's offering you. So I can understand Rabbi Frank. So he turns to his Rebbe. Who's his Rebbe? He studied in Hilbesheimer. Who did he study with? He studied with Rabbi Chaim Yaakov Weinberg. And he turns to his Rebbe and he says, "What should I do?" Now, I have to tell you that here Rebbe Chiel Yaakov, I'm going to, all this with time with Rebbe Aaron Cutler in 2 minutes, it's an unbelievable tshuva. Here Rebbe Chiel Yaakov is like the Rav. And if I may quote to you from the Rav, the world of Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, the author, again, someone I know well, quotes the Rav word by word, where the Rav says, "I will never tell anyone what to do." It's an amazing quote I have there, where the Rav exclaims, "I'm older, he's younger." That alone disqualifies me. But the Rav says, "I can help a person by explaining if you choose this way or you choose that way." Well, I hope the Rebbe is listening. Rebbe Chiel Yaakov Weinberg says, word by word, what you said, Rebbe Chiel Yaakov, Eichet Alitvisha. He goes in, he says, "Look, I can understand you can do a lot in the Gola, there are Jews there, Antwerp is a major city. On the other hand, you finally found yourself in Haifa, you finally have a position. What will the world say if you leave Eretz Yisrael and go to Antwerp? And if you leave, who says you'll ever be able to come back? Who says you'll find another position in Eretz Yisrael? Ulam lahachlit lakan ol lakan b'shum ofen eni yachol litol hachayet al atzmi." But he says that no matter what, I can't decide for you. You have to decide. It's your life. Wow. And Rabbi Chiel Yaakov doesn't tell him what to do, just outline for him. And Baruch Hashem, Rav Fink remained in Haifa. When I came in Aliyah, he was one of the well-known big Talmidei Chachamim, was Hatgahat Breitkeit, had broadness. Daughter-in-law, I believe, as well. Now, there is a footnote here. And in that footnote, Rabbi Avram Abba Weingart tells a story that he heard from Rav Fink himself and from Rav Fink's widow. Eshet Chayo, Harabanit Yehudit Fink, Aleha Hashalom. And what was the story? That at one point, Rav Fink had to visit America. And he leaves Israel, he goes to America, and in America, he goes to see many Rabbanim, including Rav Aaron Cutler. When he goes to see Rav Aaron Cutler, at that time Rav Fink was Rav in South America, not to leave Israel, I'm sorry. That's before he came to Israel. This has to be in the 1950s. At that time Rav Fink was a Rav in South America. He had not yet have found a position in Haifa. And he goes to Rav Aaron Cutler and he starts talking to Rav Aaron Cutler that he's been offered this position in Eretz Yisrael, he's been offered this position in Haifa, and he's wondering if perhaps he should leave South America and go an Aliyah. And Rav Aaron tells him exactly what the Rav said: if you're successful, you daf dotten bleiben. Exactly what the Lubavitcher Rebbe would have said: if you're successful, you have to stay there. So then he says to Rav Aaron, "Shalatar Rav Fink, vas vet zayin mit Eretz Yisrael." In other words, what'll be with Eretz Yisrael if people like us don't go in Aliyah? And Rav Aaron answers him, "Mir werden noch foren doch zusammen. We will yet go together to Eretz Yisrael." And that is what Rabbi Aaron Cutler answers him. He remains in South America. A few years go by. The job in Haifa opens. They press him to come in Aliyah. and he makes the decision to go and Aliyah. Now he's flying to Israel. Could you imagine what a trip it was then? You couldn't fly directly. So he's stopping off in Europe. And in Europe he goes to visit the Sri Dayesh in Switzerland. And now from Switzerland he is supposed to fly on to Eretz Yisrael. And the Rav in Belgium, I believe this was not in Antwerpen, but in Brussels, Harab Zweig, hears that Rav Fink is in Switzerland, and he pleads with him to cancel his return flight to come visit him, and he'll fly on from Belgium to Eretz Yisrael. Well, the nearest place you could get a flight to fly on from Belgium is in France. So Rav Fink arrives at the airport in France. This is Orly. This is before they built Charles de Gaulle. They arrive at the airport. It's 1962. He's finally on the final leg of the journey to Eretz Yisrael. And he comes into the airport. Thousands of Jews, black hats all over the place. Litvisha, Hasidisha. Can't understand what's happening. And he finds out Rav Aaron Cutler, the Aaron, was coming in from the United States, TWA, if you recall. How was it coming in? New York to Paris, Paris to Tel Aviv. And Rav Fink finds himself on the exact same plane with Rav Aaron Cutler. One, of course, alive, one not. But when Velsazaman foreign to Eretz Yisrael, and he said he and his wife sat there the whole flight, that they were like in a state of shock, a state of trauma. They couldn't believe what Rav Aaron had told them and how it came to Kiyum. But anyway, be it as it may, this is a very delicate question. Each one has to decide on his own. I am a very big religious Zionist. I hate to say it. I'm proud of it. So to me, there's never a shaila. I get very upset when people tell me. I don't rebuke people. It's not my nature, as you know. I've never given a test from the day I came in Aliyah. 45 years, I've never. I was a tyrant as a Rebbe in America. One kid, you can ask Joey Epstein, he got an 82 on my bechinah. He called his father long distance. His father was Rav in upstate New York to tell his dad he got an 82 on Rothkopf's bechinah. If I met Rothkopf, I'd smack his face for torturing kids like that. But when you come in Aliyah, you're humble. If you're not humbled, you haven't come in Aliyah. You're still breathing Chutz La'aretz air. So I've never given an exam since 1969, since I closed the doors and walked out of Yeshiva University in Manhattan. But you see, it's a delicate problem. And people talk, heartache here, panasa, I've been through it, nevertheless. But I'm not here to answer for anyone else. And it's a beautiful question, and the way Rabbi Chiel Yaakov handles it, and what a chavakan a source. See, it's not in the Shelet and Shibbet, it's in Chelik Gimel of the Chidushim that Rabbi Avraham Abba Weingart put out. The footnote is fabulous. Yes, Sam.
You don't think that Rabbi Aaron's statement that they're going to travel together to Israel was not a Rebbe Shemaisa, but he meant when Mashiach comes, we'll get there?
I don't answer. Whatever. You can take it either way, okay? I can tell you Rebbe's stories on myself. So you'll say, it's again, just chance, just, I don't know, there's Hashkach. I can't say. I'm not a chassid, but what can I tell you? I've been through too much of life to dismiss the supernatural. Okay? If we're sitting here and what we have seen, what we have been through, and I'll tell you very simply, when Washington came out, so you know I worked very hard on the chapters and what we did in Russia, because don't misunderstand me, I was the focal figure. So what I know, not many people know. The truth is there's no one left alive today who knows that part of the operation. Okay? So I put it in the print that had to go through censorship. There's certain things I left out that are just too delicate to write about. Although it's chaval, it shouldn't, because if you don't write, it's lost forever. So I have to tell you, do you believe what you read there? I mean, I don't believe it anymore. How could one little kid from the Bronx... So I tell you, isn't it Hashgacha Pratit that they come out with a book, Nativ HaDmama? This comes out from research in the Mossad, right? And when we walk into the book launch, everyone jumps at us, you're the stars. That Malcolm, you're the star, Tamakol Chavin. And I look at the book, I can't believe it. I had to write out for my grandchildren who don't have the time to read what pages Saba and Safta are mentioned on. You understand? So, it's Nishtar Abisha Maisa. Now when people, I say, you don't want to believe what's in Washington? Do you read modern Hebrew? B'nitiv HaDmama. That's where you'll see it. That's a Rebbe Shemaisa to me. Okay. Say that. So Zayin Gesund. Let me go further. Now, I want to give one more source on Reb Aaron. And I just hope that someone is listening who will do a scholarly biography of Reb Aaron. They call it a critical biography. They don't like the word critical, because critical means to be critical. It doesn't mean to be critical. It means to be scientific, to be honest. And here, of course, I come to Mishpacha magazine, and now a book has come out. I haven't seen the book, but I'm sure this is all in the book. And it's someone that's very close to us in the sense that from YU, who doesn't know the Tendler family? Alach HaTama V'Kamer, in my case, who I taught together with Reb Moshe David, I taught members of his family, I taught his daughter, I taught his daughter-in-law. I mean, I know the family intimately. I knew Shifra Zichrona Tzadeket Levracha, and it's a very fascinating case study. First of all, a little bit background. And I'm citing also there was an interview on a website with Yosef Tendler. And you know, he came from this home on the east side. His father was a rabbi, his father was a Talmud Chacham. But let it be said, the father was a wealthy man. How was the father a wealthy man? He was in real estate. This is what I was told. He owned property, he had income. One day, a Rebbe in RJJ, and you got to remember, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef was a very important yeshiva. It was the second yeshiva organized in America. When Eitz Chaim merged with the Talmudical Academy, when Eitz Chaim merged with Reitz, I should say, and formed Talmudical Academy, they gave up their elementary school. They did have for a while a 7th and 8th grade. It's not clear how long that continued. But RJJ became the focal elementary yeshiva on the American Torah scene. RJJ becomes very big with Reb Aaron Kotler. In my time, RJJ was the main feeder of students for Lakewood Yeshiva. And that continued for many years. And RJJ, after World War II, took in many immigrant children. They didn't have to pay tuition. They clothed them. They fed them. They raised them. Some of them, you know, Krabheimer. I'll give you one example. The author, he was an RJJ boy. He had a brother who died here in Israel. The brother was a total Shomer Torah and Mitzvah 100%. He was an RJJ boy. I know other kids who survived, came in from Hungary. They didn't speak Yiddish in Hungary. They spoke Hungarian. They used to say in B'nai Brak. All you heard from the streets of B'nai Brak were Hungarian. Borough Park as well. Today already, Yiddish has conquered more and more of those areas. But I can tell you, these kids haven't gedacht, ois lernen in Yiddish, like I had to break my teeth to learn Yiddish, they had to break their teeth to learn Yiddish. But they were kids who just survived with tzaris. I always tell the story, there's one family I know, they were saved by Wallenberg, Raoul Wallenberg. They were in a safe house in Budapest, the mother, the father, and three boys. And they got out with miracles, because at the end of the war, the the Germans came into the safe houses and started to kill Jews, and right in the middle they killed one Jew, they're about to shoot again, the Russians conquered and killed every German in sight, and they were left alive. So they arrive in America, so that they're penniless. The two older boys go to RJJ. Nothing. Yiddish, RJJ.
MPJ was a minor?
Minor league player. RJJ was founded in 1902. It was a major institution. Yaakov Yosef. They go to RJJ. I hope I'm right with 1902 again. If anyone wants to correct me, you're welcome. RJJ. And two older boys. They're from 100%. The third boy already, the father is starting to make money. He's in business. The third boy goes to MTA. Okay? From 100%. The fourth boy, the father already has a successful business, goes to Ramaz. Follow me? He was born in America, he goes to Ramaz. I'd like to ask you, who do you think wears the black hat in the family today? Take one guess. The kid who went to Ramaz, you follow? The two RJJ boys, the MTA boy, Baruch Hashem, they're nice from Jews. But the kid who went to Ramaz, he's the one with the black hat today. So one time a Rebbe in RJJ was sick. So they asked Rabbi Tendler's father to come and give a shiur. And he remains in RJJ for 43 years, giving a shiur and never taking a penny from the yeshiva. This is Yosef Tendler, Sifron of the Bracha. Yosef. This is, yeah. You can see the younger brother, you see the resemblance, the face. There's another brother yet who I know. I knew him from Lakewood. Now, his story is very fascinating. He was a normal, you know what you call a normal kid, like his older brother, and graduates. He's now ready to go to Yeshiva College. His father is pressing, and father was a Yid Lamdan. It's going to go into the Rav Shir. So in order to be prepared for the Rav Shir, he decides to take a break in 1950, the summer, and to go to Lakewood. And goes to Lakewood. He's learning. And the Rosh Yeshiva sees this kid from the east side, RJJ, he's going to go to college. He describes, I know this from Lakewood, there was pressure on the Rosh Yeshiva by some of the kids who were already what you call in popular Yiddish frumaks. It's not a complimentary term. They were afraid, well, how do you let this college kid come in? And but Rabaran was, you know, way above that, very smart. He saw this kid has ability. Rabaran was makarafim. He gives him a chavruta, Reb Heschel Genauer. Now, the Genauer family is very unique. It's a family from Seattle. It's an unbelievable story. I'll tell you the story. You should know what Jews, Mikamcha Yisrael Goyachad Baritz. Genauer family arrived in Seattle, it must be 130 years ago, Mashahu Kaseh. So the original Genauer was a Shomer Mitzvah. And what could he do in America? He didn't have a college degree. So he used to collect old clothes and go to wealthy homes, and do you have any old clothes to throw out? There were people there who were established, and he would rehabilitate the clothes, his wife would sew, and he would sell it, and that's how he made a living. So one time he goes to this home, it turns out the man, a gentle man, was a director of a bank, manager of a bank. And his wife gives him clothes. Yeah, my husband's throwing this out, that out. And he gives, and when he opens the pocket, he finds some heavy money in this pocket. So the next day he goes back and he says to the wife, you gave me these clothes yesterday, but here I found whatever it was, hundreds of dollars in the pocket. It's not my money, it's your money. Well, the Balabas was so impressed that he called in Genauer and he said to him, whatever business you want to start, the bank will give you a loan. The rest is history. So this Genawa family, you have to give credit. It's now probably a fifth generation in America, as far as I know. Kulam Shomrei Torah Mitzvot. We had a classmate, Zvi Genawa, who went to Bnei Brak. He was the accountant for Supersoul when it opened. And I don't know, worked for them many years. I imagine today he's retired, probably has a long beard, and I wouldn't recognize him, but he was part of the Genawa family. So he gives him a Chavruta, Reb Heschel Genawa. And, you know, this is the best that Lakewood has to offer. And he sees the Alte Kletzke, and see, here I can identify, I can feel what he's saying, that you met, this is what I said about Lakewood, it gave me a great split to be in Lakewood, because when I was in Lakewood, it was not an Americanized yeshiva. You could feel the Ruach of Kletz, you could see the all-time Talmidim, you could see those who survived, those who yet knew Rabbaran in the 1930s, and they warmed you up. And he's learning there. But he's gonna go back. He's gonna go back to New York. He's gonna go back to YU. But he can't pull himself away. And he comes back to Lakewood, Simchas Torah. And Rabbaran calls him aside. And Rabbaran says to him, why don't you remain here? Was bleibt mir nicht? And he tells Rabbaran what I told the Mashiach, what I told Reb Nosson Wachtog, exactly the same thing. You know, YU has, you can get a college degree, you can make a living, you know, that's a very important factor. I don't want to repeat the answer I got from Lakewood about me making a living, but Rabbaran Cutler says to him, who do you trust? Do you trust your own thinking, or do you want to trust me? I'm so much older than you, and I've had so much more life experience. At your age, you don't have to worry about anything. You have the seichel of a teenager. I have that of an older man. I have been around. You can trust me. You learn in Lakewood, and you'll be able to make a living as well. And he cancels his YU registration, and as they say, the rest is history. Now, his description of Lakewood is very fascinating because, and this from Machanech, there's so much to talk about here, so much insight. He says in Lakewood there were some guys who basically were bums. I remember in Lakewood, I can tell you his name, he was a terrible das boy. The guy, he used to boast, I'm at Minyan, by Baruch Hu. You understand? Minyan at Baruch Hu. Ribbono Shel Olam, I can tell you, Eidet Nemana, that a guy named Rakefet, he walks into the shtibel, the side of Ohel Rivka, 5:15 to 5:18 every morning. The minyan begins at 5:30. I will probably have to make it 5 minutes later when they change the clock, 5:35. But Baruch Hu, well, I saw one guy running today, I thought he'd knock me over. Big, tall, healthy, husky guy. He was a little late. I was going to put Svarim back and was already right before Baruch Shama. He was running, and so I remember this guy used to boast, Baruch Hashem, by Baruch Hu he gets to Minyan. Oh, nice, Fafa, bum. What are you, Baruch Hu, you get to Minyan, Baruch Shama, Psukei Dezimra. Person has to dive in. You're talking to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Who are you talking to? Anyway, so he describes how they would press Rabbaran, what are these bums doing in the yeshiva? And Rabbaran would say, you could never tell what comes out of a kid. Right now, he's not the top, he's not a tzaddik, but he may be turned on. And he's Chabal, he doesn't give names, but Bobby is reasoning that he said, and he said, some of these guys became Gedolei Rashi Yeshiva in the United States and in Israel. So you see, that was Rebbe Aaron. He describes, it's a beautiful interview, he describes Rebbe Moshe Feinstein, who was his neighbor on the east side, and he describes how one time Rebbe Moshe goes upstate to help a Rav to be Masadar again. And he says to Reb Moshe, by now already he's a Talmud Mufak of Reb Aaron Katan, one of the earliest American born Talmudim, and he says to Reb Moshe, why do you work so hard to go up stage? You know, and the traveling's exhausting. The older you get, the harder it becomes. And Reb Moshe answers him, this Rav can go either way. He can remain an Elecha, or he can become a compromiser. If I go upstate and I'm with him and I help him give a get and everyone sees I'm with him, he will not be a compromiser. Et vet Leiben an Elecha. And then he tells the story of how to debate in Baltimore with Chashak had other plans. Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg had recently founded a Mechina High School at Neir Yisrael in Baltimore, and he was seeking a 12th grade Rebbe. In 1961, by the way, Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg was one of these were all graduates of Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg was Reb Rudiman's son-in-law, and Dov Schwartzman, who we spoke about, Rabbi Aaron's son-in-law, recommended Rabbi Yosef Talmud for the position, and that's where he remained all his life. 1964, he became the Menachel of the Mechina, which he would lead until his final days. Now, there's one other part to the interview with him, which didn't appear in Mishpacha, but appeared on the website. And that part we can all identify with. Why? The world has moved so much to the right that when you tell stories today, what it was like growing up, and you know, we grew up, if you recall, candy bars. We read the ingredients. No one looked for the what, who, what, when, where, had a haksha. Not only that, I can tell you in Lakewood, in my time, they ate Mounds bars on Shabbos. They thought they were parva. Understand? Because it turns out in America, if it has less than 2% of the ingredients, it doesn't have to be listed. And it turns out Mounds bars do have milk chocolate in it, but a very small amount. So it could be it was batel b'shishim. I want to be melamed skut. But I can tell you that batel b'shishim today or tomorrow, none of us would eat a Mounds bar with chocolate today. O-U-D. But I can tell you in Lakewood, Mounds bar, they read and read, and you tell people what it was like. Or it came up in class yesterday. I forgot how, with the women covering their hair, and something with Reb Menashe Klein, I forget it. I forgot what. So I told them, people always attack me, the Rav's wife. So I always answer, the Rav's wife you worried about? Go back to Lithuania. Ribbono shel Olam, I can give you a list of Gedolei Yisrael who came to America, whose wives did not cover their hair, period. But when you say that today, I'm not, God forbid, I'm not in favor of women not covering their hair. My wife covers their hair. My children cover their hair. My granddaughters-in-law cover their hair. Baruch Hashem, I'm not in favor of a but the truth is the truth. The truth is there's one sefer that goes into a long analysis halachically to be melamed schut on the women that come, was published in America in 1924, 1925. He was a Rav Horowitz of, I believe, Hartford, Connecticut, was a Lamdin Mufak. The Rav held him to be bigger than Rav Moshe Feinstein. There was once a machlokes between them. The Rav held that Rav Horowitz was right. And there, so I once cited that footnote in public. The demand for that sefer became so big that they republished it. I got a free copy out of it. They published it. They said, you cited it. And everyone wants to see it. His grandchildren and great-grandchildren republished the sefer. So he has one cute thing. When I was in Lakewood, the yeshiva served regular milk and breadstone sour cream. There was no Chalav Yisrael. Recently, one of my grandsons was sitting in class in a school in Lakewood, and the teacher was talking about Reb Aaron. My grandson raised his hand and said, quote, my grandfather says that Reb Aaron allowed none Chalav Yisrael to be served in the yeshiva dining room, end quote. The Rebbe said, Reb Aaron would never allow such a thing? Evidently, that Rebbe looks at Lakewood then as it is now. So, very fascinating individual, but this was Reb Aaron Cutler. This was the impression. This was an American kid who had traveled and was already in YU, and how he remains with Reb Aaron Cutler in Lakewood, and the rest is history. And you can multiply Reb Yosef Pendler by 10 examples, later 100 examples, ultimately 1,000 examples, and I think they would claim in Lakewood today by 10,000 examples. Is it a Lakewood where you can have Breakstone's cottage cheese? Absolutely not. But it's a Lakewood that changed the course of Torah history in the Western world and had impact on the state of Israel as well. Yes, Chaim.
Because of this, they have some Nachal Yisrael things in the Neir Yisrael cafeteria today.
They have none Chalav Yisrael, you say?
A couple of things, not the milk. Rabbi Kandler himself owned the milk farm.
Yeah, that's right. He owned the milk farm to provide Chalav Yisrael. But what do they have, for instance? I know Reb Meisha's sons. I know Reb Reuven used to use Kavel, and he claimed that it's not Chalavakum because it's made with milk powder. And the old story, that milk powder didn't exist at the time that the Yisrael began.
Right, and more than that, they had their father, and I recall sometimes they had cream cheese.
Okay, Baruch Hashem. Well, I can tell you a famous story with the Rav that my Talmidim, you know, where he was Gabayim. So they told me a story, it has to be late 70s, early 80s. So the Rav Lo Aleinu suffered from ulcers. He had to drink a lot of milk. So he asked his shamus, they used to call it, he should get me a quart of milk. It was a machine, I guess, in the dormitory. And the shamusim turned to each other behind the Rav's back. What does he mean? What does Rebbe mean? What type of milk? Does he want Chalav Yisrael? It's the 70s already, late 70s, early 80s. The swing to the right is in full force. And the Rav turns around, what's the problem? A quart of Delwood milk! And that solved the problem very quickly. But I have to say that the Chalav Yisrael industry today, when you see what they produce and what they import from Israel, it's overwhelming. I mean, they lack basically for nothing. In Israel, obviously, Chalav Yisrael is not a problem. But in Chutz Laaretz, compared to what we recall Chalav Yisrael out of the 50s, Balsam, right? That was one of the first, J&J. Half the time the milk was sour, the trucks that delivered it, they weren't refrigerated, etc., etc. Nowadays, Kol Tov Mitzrayim. Baruch Hashem. Let me go one step further. I want to do justice to Reb Aaron. One step further. Reb Nesson Kamenetsky, and I know him, and he's a sweet, a very special individual. I don't know who's bigger, Reb Shmuel or Reb Nesson, but let me tell you, Reb Nesson has a world of knowledge. By the way, I want to make another correction where I was wrong. When I described Reb David Lipschitz's three daughters, Chaya Waxman, married to Professor Chaim Waxman, is the middle daughter. I made her the youngest. The youngest is married to Reb Chaim Stein's son, Reb Binyamin Stein, and he's alive and well. There is someone in the family who died. He's alive and well, Baruch Hashem. So as I questioned, if anyone knows, and Chaim Waxman told me his brother-in-law is alive and well. So it's Reb Nesson, Reb Chaim, and Reb Binyamin Stein. So Reb Nesson Kamenetsky, very, very sweet individual, very knowledgeable, and got involved, and he never graduated high school. In my review and my defense of Making of a Gadol, I have a line there that although Reb Nesson never graduated, he lacked some credits in gym or something. He never bothered to, went to Lakewood, never bothered to graduate. So I wrote, even though he's not a high school graduate, I had to hold an unabridged Webster dictionary next to his book, because he uses words that I don't know what he's talking about. I had to look up the translation. Now, there was this tremendous outcry against the making of a gadol, which you all know about, And as I've said more than once, it was led by certain elements of the Lakewood crowd, the Schwartzman family, the Wachtvogel family. They were furious on what he wrote about Rabarin, although every last syllable was true. But when you're raised on Art Scroll, Gedolim were born with yarmulkes on their heads. Rabarin was not born with a yarmulke on his head, and there was a certain point in his life when he's going to Moscow to join his sister, and believe me, he was going to very soon, had that worked out, be without a yarmulke on his head. So after Reb Nosson's book appeared, there was this tremendous controversy, the Haramim, the burning of the book on the streets of Matastov. All the Israeli press had a field day, the New York Times had a field day. I need not tell you what went on. So a volume appeared in America, an in-house volume, I'll show you what I mean by unreliable at times, by a Talmud of Rabarin, Rabbi Yitzchak Dershowitz, The Legacy of Maran Rabarin Kotler. Okay? Now, what am I speaking about? Where it was different than Reb Nosson Kamenetsky? What are they upset about? Could you imagine on page 62 where he writes about Rabarin about to leave Slabodka? Yeah, and you know, I'll just repeat the story very quickly. I think I've said it before, that Malka Kotler was Rabarin. Remember, these kids were orphaned at an early age. The Rosh Yeshiva's mother passed away when he was 3, his father when he was 9. He was raised by his uncle, who was a dayan in Minsk, and his sister. This is the era where the communism, socialism, and these ideas, anarchism, are conquering 99% of Jewish children. We Jews are at the head of every humanistic movement. And these ideas are very appealing. I've told you more than once, again, here, my Talmud Rabbi Gachman has to worry about money at the end of the month. My Talmud Rabbi Meiselman is a multimillionaire. Is that fair? They're two human beings. Why should he be so wealthy and he should be poor? The communist system is fabulous. Each according to his abilities and each according to his needs. Fabulous. Beautiful. Let's all be communists. All right. These ideas captivated the youth. You have to understand that. I told you more than once, Jacob Dienstock told me, Zichrono Livracha, Professor Dienstock, the man was what he knew was unbelievable, a librarian, Gottesman Library, but wow, what he knew on Maimonides scholarship. So he told me more than once, if you weren't a socialist or a communist in your youth, you were not young. He says, it's like today, if you're not B'nai Akiva in your youth, you're not young. So Rabarin's sister already was caught up with the new movement. She was in Moscow. She was a university graduate. She was not religious. So she was sending letters to Rabarin in Slabodka. Come, open your mind, get an education. It's a new world. A new world is dawning. And the out of Slabodka intercepted the letters, did not give them to Rabarin. Rabarin finally found out what was happening. He was upset, he was mad, he was angry, and he's ready to leave Slabodka and join his sister. And Rav Reuven Krizovsky was the one that was Rav Baruch Berlebovich's son-in-law, later the Rosh Kolel of Beit Midrash Elyon in Spring Valley, which was a shooter from Torah Vadas. And Rav Reuven Krizovsky, as if they say, pulled them off the bus that was going to lead him to Moscow. Now, on page 62, he rewrites history, and he writes, let me just find the exact quote, yeah. Even in Slabodka, however, the Rosh Yeshiva was not totally shielded from danger, for he had an older sister who was religious, but secular, education oriented, and would write to him in Slabodka itself to try to induce him to forsake yeshiva for the glories of the outside world. So you see, and I can give you many other examples from the book that are totally inaccurate. And I told Reb Nissen, I didn't need you to tell me about his sister, because I knew people who knew the sister. Reb Nissen tells the story, I knew the people involved. I can throw out one name of someone who should live and be well, Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld, youngest year at Kew Gardens Hills. The queen, in later years, when Reb Aaron finally got his sister to America after many years of teaching in Moscow and teaching in Paris and the universities, and finally, and she had never married, no children, no grandchildren, and Reb Aaron brings her to America, they finally put her in a senior citizen's residence. And Reb Aaron asked the rabbinate in Queens, Tuma Teva, this is the 1950s, do me a favor, visit my sister once a month, she should have some company, my elder Shvesta Malka, my older sister Malka. And one time, Roy Albert, the photography editor of the Rav Zeichet Tzadik Levracha, Roy tells me he got a call from Fabian. Fabian says, Roy, you have time today? You don't have a funeral today? Because Roy, he was in a congregation of older people, and all the rabbis used to joke with him that he's the only rabbi that works full time with funerals. So he says, Roy, you don't have a funeral today? Come with me. We promised Reb Aaron, the Klepsker Rosh Yeshiva, that will visit his sister. It'll be interesting for you. And they go to the senior citizens, and there is this lady, Malka Cutler, can you imagine, from Gedolei Gedolei Israel. And this is the 1950s, the late 50s, when Reb Aaron was the Gadol Shebe Gedolim, was the Gadol Hadar. Reb Aaron had transformed America. And Ziba Klokzik, she tells these rabbis, Ziba Klokzik, how would you say that in English? She's crying, she's upset with herself. Bemoaning. She what?
Bemoaning.
Good. That's better than what I said. Bemoaning herself. That I my Bruder hat a zaklara copy, has such a good head. He could have been the greatest mathematician in the world. Why didn't he listen to me? What did he become? A kleiner Rebbele, a little Rebbe. That's Malka. You're not going to find it in this book. What's fascinating in the name of the book. The Legacy of Maran Rav Aaron Cutler. He writes about I believe your family, you know, your cousin is mentioned in the book.
And who's the author?
The author is Yitzchak Dershowitz, from the Dershowitz family. It's a second cousin to my neighbor Sam Dershowitz. And he has, what's interesting is he has eyewitnesses that, you see, Yankele Weisberg I knew so well. Zichrona Levracha, when he died, I cried. I knew him so well. To me, he represented Reb Aaron Lakewood. I used to help him raise money. He's related by marriage to Vic Snow. Vic Snow, who's in Florida now, who sat and who was in the class, he's related to Vic Snow. So Yankele Weisberg describes how Reb Aaron, after he comes to Penn Station, that original time, and finally they start the Vachatzalah, and then he holds that meeting in a shul in downtown New York on the east side, and a 100+ Americans and immigrants, B'nai Torah, kids who want Torah, kids who love Torah. And Rabbi Yaakov Weisberg describes how he came to that meeting, and Rabbi Aaron, who went, again, everyone says his stature was not impressive, he was so short, but when he spoke, he was alive, he burned, he yelled, he shouted, and Rabbi Aaron speaks, and that meeting, Yaakov Weisberg already was signed up to go to college, he was going to take accountancy, he dropped everything, went to Lakewood, never stopped learning, never went to college. One talk from Reb Aaron. And what Reb Aaron always used to quote, and we have this on a recording as well, Reb Aaron quotes the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Sadi Tet Amud Aleph, it's in Chelek, where the Gemara dashens on the Pasuk in Vamidbar, Ki Devar Hashem Baza, V'et Mitzvoto Chaser, Hikareish Hanepeshaki Avonaba. What does it mean? Ki Devar Hashem Baza. that you mock the word of the Lord. And the Gemara gives many examples, but one example Rav Aaron quoted, Kol shefshal asot b'torah ve'eino osei. That if you have the ability to learn Torah, you have the ability to study Torah, and you don't do it, the Vahashem Baza. Could you imagine? You go to college, you go to graduate school, you waste your time, you could be learning Torah. Kol shefshala sok b'torah ve'eino osek, the Vahashem Baza. And Rabbanu would get hysterical with that quote. And that quote, time and again, Rav Aaron would hit home. And I have to tell you, very powerful. The whole question, can we go to high school? Can we go to college? Can we study general studies? Beyond, leave out Panasa. What about if you love English literature? What about if you love Russian literature? War and Punishment. All the great Russian writers. There's no end to the question. Leisure time. It's come up now recently. I happen to know that a guy named Rob Kaffert looked at the Yankee website this morning to see what the Yankees did yesterday in spring training. They lost. Panetta, but he pitched well. They're all excited. They may come out of that trade with something. Are you allowed? Are you allowed? I can tell you in parentheses that it's less of a shaila to go to the Yankee website than to go to college. Ellie, can you tell me why? It's very simple. To go to college is mamish Beatles' mom. You have to use your... To go to the Yankee website, it is like medicine. You're young again. You're a kid again. It is fabulous. And Rav Aaron would go crazy against college, against Yeshiva College. And this is why his relationship with the Rav was always filled with dialectical tension. Two great minds, two Litvisha Gadolim. Who could learn better? We can't say. But the Rav, the broadness, Ellie, college, university, Rabaran Tvashem Baza, head on collision. And here he has story after story. Rabaran was asked to be Sandik at a bris, and the Rosh Yeshiva said, only on condition. The father promises that he will not send this boy to college. Already at the Brit, Rav Aaron wanted that promise. His description of Lakewood, exactly as I recall it. Dining room, small converted house, maybe 100 students, 102, 103, sat around at tables. At the head table, Rav Aaron sat. When his wife was there, she sat next to him, obviously. And anyone on that table, every seat, went with chazaka. And you never got a chance to eat the cholent when it was hot. Henny, the cook who I described, Mrs. Berman, what a fabulous individual. What their acherits for Rav Aaron. And poor Mrs. Berman, hot food brought out. Rav Aaron spoke and learning all the time. Everyone gathered around him like this. They leaned forward. Rabbi Yankel Schiff. Others, it was a sight. Rav Aaron, kulo Torah. And on that level, the book has a lot that offers itself to you, because there's information here, eyewitness information, which you're not going to get anywhere else. But what's important is to be able to understand the truth what was and not which we wish had happened. And finally, let me end off the class. One more type of student. We described the Klepska, the old timers, those who went through Shanghai, those who went through Siberia. We described the American-born kids, Rabbi Yosef Tendler. And finally, a kid who studied in Lakewood, and Rabbi Aaron lost him. This kid didn't remain there. But Lakewood left a deep imprint in his soul. And if this kid could later write 7 volumes about Torah and understanding of at least the Litvish world, it goes back to Rabbi Aaron. If there's a little in there with understanding about the Hasidic world, that he picked up from the Rav. And I just want to quote to you from this volume. To get into Lakewood, I had to take an exam. And I had to go to Brooklyn, I had to go to Borough Park, I had to walk up 3 flights where Rabbi Aaron lived. I expected to see angels in the house, Rabbi Aaron Kotler. I came with such awe. The day of my scheduled examination arrived and I took the subway to Brooklyn where the Rosh Yeshiva resided in Borough Park. In my juvenile mind, I imagined I would encounter angels in the home of the Klepska Rosh Yeshiva. His apartment was on the 3rd floor of a walk-up building. The dining room served as his study, living room, and above all, the playroom for his grandchildren. While we sat at the table with the Talmudic tome spread out in front of us, dots were being shot at targets set up against the wall. The heavenly angels evidently had to yield to the younger temporal angels. I like what that guy wrote. I'll summarize the next paragraph. It's B'didi HaViyuvda. So Rabbi Aaron, who was Masechet Kedushin, I was learning in the yeshiva, and Rabbi Aaron threw a difficult question at me, and let me say it in Yiddish, I gave the exact answer that the Mashah gave. I'll never forget Rabbi Aaron, his eyes, no pupils, little Sifrei Torah. He was aglow. It took me many years to understand why, what. But imagine an American kid with no background. Where do I come from? Who were my parents? Who were my grandparents? The struggle of emigration. Immigrants. An American kid. I was accepted. Lakewood was Lakewood, and everything I described to you was correct. But let me end off the class with one description, again, B'didi HaViyuvda, that becomes the touchstone of my life, my existence, the words I said to the Mismachim the other day, my entire understanding of who we are, where we are, why God put us into this moment in time. It was very simple. Lakewood, as I mentioned to you, was a winter resort. It's long before Jews could fly down to Florida by the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands every winter. Well, if you're a winter resort, you're hot as hell during the summer. And during the summer, Lakewood was hot as you can imagine. If you dropped an egg on the street, within minutes, it was a fried egg. It was hot. No, American kids are innovative, are ingenious. We figured out a way to go back and forth from the building where we slept to the Beis Medrash where we davened. Figured out a way, the dining room, there were three little buildings in my time. Figured out a way. Make it less hot. Take the jacket and fling it over your shoulders. If you do that, you don't put your hands in the sleeves, it's not that hot. You need a jacket to daven. This is Lakewood. This is not a B'nai Kivanik. It's not Israel. Whoever heard in my youth davening without a jacket, unheard of. Davening without a hat, a jacket. But how do you manage? But then we were worried. Wearing a jacket that way may not be proper. This may be carrying. A jacket is made to be worn, to put your hands in the sleeves, to fling it over your shoulders. Maybe it's tiltul, even shaloka derech, but lachatchilar it's asur. So we decided to ask Reb Aaron. I was the youngest kid there. I was maybe 16 at the time. The older you are, the more you appreciate greatness. The older kids were frightened stiff of Reb Aaron. So I said, I was a wise Alec kid, I said, ich that threatened the Rosh Yeshiva. We waited for him to come back from Borough Park. He wasn't there that Shabbat. Monday, Rosh Yeshiva comes back, Tuesday, whatever it was. I was going to give shir during the week. It depended when the Rosh Yeshiva was there for Shabbos. The shir centered around Shabbos, Matzoi Shabbos, Sunday. But when he came during the week, there would be a major shir during the week. And there was a little room in front of the Beis Medrash. This had been a converted house, which was Reb Aaron's study. In that room, there was a special shas that no one could touch. It was a shul singer, beautiful bound shas with a blue cover. I see it in front of my eyes, given to the Rosh Yeshiva, if I'm not mistaken, by Mr. Klein of Barton's Candy. No one could touch that. The Rosh Yeshiva's private shas in his study. I knock on the door. Reb Aaron Kumarayim, come in. I come in and I tell Reb Aaron, Reb Aaron looks at me. I asked the shaila. I had guts. They were waiting outside. And Reb Aaron gave an answer. I don't know if he realized what he did with that answer, but he totally changed my understanding of life and Torah, and it's with me until today. He said, didn't quote a Mishnah Brura, didn't quote a Magen Avram, didn't quote a Taz, Avada Dafta Sein Mutter. Certainly it has to be permissible. Gegangen Azeyin Slabotka und der Alte und der Levush Mordechai haben uns nicht bemerkt. We went that way in Slabotka. That's the way we dressed on Shabbos. It was hot there too. And neither the Rosh Yeshiva, the Levush Mordechai, or the Mashgiach, Reb Natan Zvi Finkel, the Alta, didn't come to us, didn't mention anything, didn't reprimand us, didn't correct us. And at that moment, what Reb Aaron did, he took a little American kid, and he lifted him up, and he put him 50, 60 years earlier in Slabatka. That's what Torah is all about. This is Mesorah. This is tradition. This is why we're Jews. This is why we are Torah Jews. This is the heart of Judaism. Years later, I heard the Rav put it into a theological stance when he was Masbid Rav Chaim Hella. The remnant that survives. This is what Torah is all about. You want to be a tzaddik? You want to be a chassid? You want to be a zakein? You're not going to do it on your own. You have to come in contact with the remnant of yesteryear. And all my life, I've lived with one concept, not to embarrass my rebellion, not to embarrass those that taught me 50, 60 years ago. This is Torah. And this is what Rav Aaron answered us. Wow. What a moment in time. I have more, but we're going to have to leave it. I wouldn't miss next week's Shegur, what I'm going to leave you with, and ask a question. Ribbono Shel Olam, for all the lectures that are given on postgraduate levels in all the universities in the state of Israel, I claim that the question I will leave you with at the end of Rav Aaron Kotler will be worth more than all that will be said that day in every university. Sam, what is troubling your mind?
Okay, so Yachtens, I'm a native Yiddish speaker who's also a linguist.
Okay.
When somebody says, "Wenn sie haben das nicht bemerkt," the translation is, "when they didn't notice it." Not that they didn't remark on it.
No.
Bemerkt is not a Yiddish word for remark.
That's the way he said it to me. Sam, das nicht bemerkt.
That means they didn't notice.
No. He left me with the impression, black and white, they didn't correct us.
Because Bamert is not
say that, I remember the word like it happened yesterday. But they nicht Bamert. If they would have noticed, they would have said something. Had they noticed it negatively, that's the implication of what Rav Aaron was saying to me. But since I'm not a native Yiddish speaker, perhaps, no, you have to be sorry, perhaps I'm misquoting him. 1 second.
Bamert is to make a comment.
To make the, yeah, that's
what. They didn't comment on it.
They didn't comment.
By not, this is Shtika called off.
Shtika, yeah, exactly, exactly. Okay, the gentlemen, it's okay, I can.
Well, it could be a difference of opinion.
I'm very happy to hear what a person who knows more than I do about Yiddish, but nevertheless, I agree with Yitzchak. That's the way Rav Aaron used the word, and wow, it was that basic. And that's the Rav too. You know, the Rav once said, forget about the Hispan Rapine Hala, the Rav went, where are we different than conservative rabbis? You know, this is when the seminary was halachic, so called. Where are we different? They wear kippot, we wear kippot. They quote from the Bible, we quote from the Bible. But tradition. The plate of Sofreihem. Okay, so what did we do today? We're practically finished with Rav Aaron. I'm setting the stage for what comes next. But we did a world today. Rav Yosef Tendler, Yitzchak Dershowitz, Devar Hashem Bazar, a few words from Rakefet, and we'll continue next week. I have a drop more to go on Rav Aaron and the Rav. I have to develop one question that you can think about. I'm thinking about it. I was asked the question a few weeks ago, and
what was the question?
We'll deal with that next week. It can't be dealt with cheaply. Now, I want to mention that I have a dear student here, was my student many times over from BMT, the Kollel, and beyond. And his name is Rabbi Aaron Goldscheider. His late father actually was a year behind me in Yeshiva College. I think your father graduated in 1960. He was sandwiched between me and my brother. Mm-hmm. I was 59, and I believe my brother, had he ever graduated college, would have been 61 or 62, 61. But my brother became a butcher. Albert Einstein was beginning, and they wanted to get bright kids to build a reputation, so they announced any junior in college who has a certain average can apply to Albert Einstein, and my brother wound up never graduating college. So I want to tell you that Rabbi Goldscheider has just presented me with a beautiful gift, and I have to say, of all the svarim in our library that we have, nothing has had more additions than the Haggadah. And I'll tell you why. And what a beautiful... Wow, and the commentary, teaching stories and questions from Rabbi Cook, Rabbi Soloveitchik, and Rabbi Kalbach. And who asked me a few minutes before class, who asked me, how can you combine Rabbi Cook, Rabbi Soloveitchik, and Rabbi Kalbach? If you know Rabbi Goldscheider, you can understand it. And I have to tell you, Rabbi Goldscheider once asked me advice, and he didn't listen to me. He was looking for a rabbinate after he couldn't break away from Israel. He came, he was in the Kollel, he was in the rabbinate in Jacksonville. Then he came back to Israel, and then he was offered a position in Baltimore and a position in Mount Kisco. And I told him, go to Baltimore, you have little children. It's a near the Ein be Yisrael. But it was a shul, he said, Baltimore has moved right wing, and this shul is like modern Orthodox, and he would be looked upon as the Shegetz rabbi. Well, you're not the only one. Rabbi Wahlberg is there too. So you would have been one of the Shegetz rabbis in Baltimore. And instead he chose a little shul, Mount Kisco. And I visited him there. I'll never forget that experience. It was a lesson to me. And you know, you live in Israel too long, you forget what the Gola is about. But I can just give you one little insight. The shul was alive, and there was a gabbai there who had been there for many decades. And after he heard me speak, he made a bracha on me. I became an apple, you understand? I thank him. I was very moved, very touched, but I'm not worthy of such bracha. That's for the Rav, for Moshe Feinstein, not for a little kid who goes to the Yankee website. Maybe it's important to go. Anyway, and he has these people davening and singing and shaking, and among them is a guy who's in the International Committee of Varsameach, right? I have it right, memory's not bad. And Aaron tells me, he was there a number of years already, he says, I don't even have a minyan Shomer Shabbos. I say, what are you talking about? Look at these people, look, they're davening, look, they're wearing tichels. He says, Rebbe, you don't understand. That's part of being in shul at these minutes, but you'll see what happens. Well, we have a bikiddush, we go out, and right next to the shul is the, in my time it's called Penn Train, I don't know what it's called today, New Haven Railroad it was called, what's it called today? That's a new word. The New Haven Railroad, big, big station with endless cars parked there. And we're walking out with his wife, with my wife, with the children, Shabbistic people, and here are people who just were davening, singing with kavana, getting into their cars, waving to us, good Shabbos, Shabbat Shalom, and driving off. It was a shakaroo for me. That's all I can say. On another level, I can tell Aaron something he may or may not remember, that Saturday night we showed the documentary on the Rav. So first of all, from Mount Kisco, always at the Herzog family, these are very famous Hasidim who owned Kevin Wine. They came to see the documentary, but you don't know what happened to me that night. It was one of the most moving moments, because the man who paid for the documentary, who, not so much because of me, although he was impressed by my two volumes on the Rav, on his Rebbe, my wife's family davened in his father's shul. He was related to Reb Moshe. You understand? He was related to Reb Moshe. So his grandson and granddaughter-in-law were sent by him to see me. They knew I was in Mount Kisco, and they made the whole trip up in the snow from Riverdale, where they were for Shabbos, to thank me for taking $1 million from here to put out that document. And they really meant it. So I want to tell the world that's listening, the night that unites Passover Haggadah, teaching stories and questions from Rabbi Cook, Rabbi Soloveitchik, and Rabbi Kalbach. Who puppet? Puppet? Urim.
And all the Rabbi Soloveitchik material has been approved by Rabbi Rakefet.
Okay, Kala Kavod, Kala Kavod. Not to Rakefet, but to Rabbi Goldscheider. I also want to mention another member of this kollel, Harav Moshe David Weissman, who heads up a kollel in Beitari Lit, and was a very wonderful Talmud of mine, has put out a second disc entitled Avoda Shebalev number 2. He is fabulous. So be aware, he is trying to bridge the worlds of Lakewood and YU in Israeli context. Gentlemen, Kimmy, I have a world of freebies. Anyone into the Baal Tshuva movement, this is a Yitzchak, I have material to give you. Don't run away. This is, I have to give you from Michael Miller. This is an article right before Reb Noach Weinberg died. It's a very insightful interview with him. It's kedai if you're involved with Baalei Tshuva, grab it. This is from the Board of Education in Israel, the religious division, my Talmud Rabbi Aryeh Weinberger. Hasn't hepatized his name yet. He's been here with my Talmud out of the early 70s. Fabulous guy. If you have children and you want to entertain them over the month of Nisan and Pesach and all that we have, you have all the material in the book. This is a chapter from Rabbi Moshe Meiselman's new book, Torah, Chazal, and Science. He quotes me in this chapter. Read it and get back to me with your feelings about the chapter. It's very, very interesting. Now, Yitzchak, I have two copies. So one anyone can have, and one is from Michael Miller. No one in the world can believe what happened now with this guy who wouldn't give his wife a get, a frum guy, and he just remarried, got a chet to Meir Rabbanim, the New York Times article, that's from Michael Miller. He almost fainted yesterday when I mentioned it in context.
Is the wife in Baltimore?
No. This is Los Angeles. And the basin is from Muncie. And the Rav Masada Kedushin was the Av Beistin who flew out there. Okay, one second.
They met the existing on the basis of a Hetzer Meir Rabbanim.
Hetzer Meir Rabbanim.
But it wouldn't work the other way.
God have mercy. What a Chilul Hashem. This is for Michael Miller, Sandy Koufax interview. Now, for anyone who's going into Chinuch, I cannot tell you how much insight I could lecture on this article for half a year. It is a visit with the Rebbetzin, with the Rebbe's wife, okay? A visit with the Rebbetzin. If you're going into Chinuch, please take this article. I have two copies. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, it's with the Lubavitcher Rebbetzin. There's only one Rebbetzin, Chaya Mashka. It's a fabulous, fabulous, insightful, how wise that woman was. Here is a big announcement which I couldn't believe. They are taking orders for Rabbi Joseph Talushkin's new book about the life of the Rebbe. Joseph Talushkin. You're dealing here with a YU graduate, a heavyweight. One second, this doesn't count. Okay. Who here has the Baltimore connection? This is all about the greatest Gaon to ever live in Baltimore, HaRav HaGaon Rav Michal Forschlager. And they're coming out with a book about his life. And very, Rav Aaron Cutler called him the greatest Gaon in the United States. Anyone involved in YU with the Machlekes going on in YU, here is an article by Zev Elif on the, which Machlekes? The ordination that they tried to annul. And they quote heavily from my book on Rabbi Revel. They should have asked me, I would have given them more material. Now, this is, I found out, the Cherem that was published in Grus for Purim was done by Rabbi Bednash. I complimented him because I thought it was done by Professor Moshe Kopel. Rabbi Bednash never got a bigger compliment in his life that Rakepet put him in the class of Moshe Kopel. But I got, Rabbi Bednash was good enough to give me a copy of Moshe Kopel's Brooklyn Chayrim, and I found out I was not Yotze Pashat Zohar. And it's very simple. The Sefer HaChinuch says women are not Chayavot in Pashat Zohar, because only if you're involved with Mechatin Cheket Amalek can you have a Chir of Pashat Zohar. Since women are not allowed to fight, they can't put on clothes of men, and guns and etc. are clothes of men, they can't go to war, they can't fight, they have no Chir of Pashat Zohar. That's Taka true. That's the Chinuch. That's Rav Asher Weiss Pashas like the Chinuch, by the way. There's no Chir. Well, if a yeshiva boy is exempt from the army and he doesn't go to fight, he has no chiyuv in Parshat Zohar. This, if you know my good friend Moshe Kaplan, married to my student, this is Moshe at his best. Those of you who want the other Shegetz rabbi from Baltimore, these are two drashot by Rabbi Michelle Wahlberg. His brother was my classmate. Fabulous drashot. If you're a Jew, you got to see these drashot. This will blow you away. They went to the grave of Reb Shmuel Shmelka, the great Reb Shmuel Shmelka, one of the great Hasidic Rebbeim of the third generation. Do you know why they went to the grave of Reb Shmuel Shmelka? Because he is the great, 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 great grandfather of Yapir Lapid. And they went to daven that there shouldn't be a Gezerah. Finally, the Svarim blog, my Talmud Rabbi Dr. Professor Mark Shapiro, goes into the whole question once again of the Netziv reading newspapers on Shabbos.
It's not Mark, that's someone else.
That's someone else, but it's from the Svarim blog, right?
Yeah.
Who went into it? Who is it?
It has his name right there.
Oh, Eliezer Brot. Excuse me, I'm giving Mark the credit, because generally you give me the Svarim blog, it's Mark. I can't believe what he came up with. But I challenge Chaim Meiselman. I get this picture, the Netziv reading a newspaper. I want to ask you, why does that look like a newspaper? To me it looks like a sefer. Okay, how can we prove that's a newspaper? Is it? Isn't it? And how do we know that's the Netziv? I never saw a picture, that's the Netziv. What is unbelievable. My dear students, next Sunday is another day. Reb Menashe Klein battling the fellows from Lakewood. Until we meet again in health and happiness. Das Vidanya. That's Chabad. That's Reb Yoel.
This is all just some reading a paper?
Yeah.
Try to waste the time.